three novels this evening. The narrator of Room by Emma Donoghue is Jack, a smart, daring little five-year-old who has been trapped along with his mother in an 11 by 11 foot room since the day he was born. Taya Obrett's deeply layered tale, set in an unnamed country in the Balkans, The Tiger's Wife, is reviewed for us by author Barbara Quick. And Pat Nolan and publisher Irene Nolan join me in the second half of the broadcast for a conversation about Pat's novel, a Western set on the last day in the life of a legendary lawman. But let's begin now with Rosemary Manchester and the noted Virginia Woolf scholar J.J. Wilson and their conversation about Emma Donoghue's much-praised novel, Room. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and my guest in the studio tonight is J.J. Wilson, who is Professor Emeritus from Sonoma State, a leading light in the greater literary community, and also a very good friend. We're discussing Emma Donoghue's book, Room. J.J. and I both have found this book interesting, challenging, compelling.
Intense.
And perhaps not for everyone.
I would disagree with that. I would want everyone to give it a try because I really see that it's a book about all kinds of topics which you wouldn't naturally turn to, probably. Language acquisition, reality and unreality. It's existential. In a way, that sounds like a big deal, but there's nothing so existential as children. And you've got a narrator who's 5 years old.
Since we don't have the author in the studio, I thought I would read several things from the critics that have been written about the book, lest you think that J.J. and I just got carried away by a book that nobody else liked. This is a very well-liked and well-awarded book. Let me also mention that it has a great plot. I couldn't put it down. Many people have said they just read it straight through because they couldn't put it down. Imagine living within the confines of 11 by 11 room, the only natural light coming from a skylight, a television, your only link to the outside world. That's just what Donoghue does in Room, told in the pitch-perfect voice of a five-year-old boy raised in captivity. Donoghue's stunning novel offers a unique portrait of one mother's fierce devotion. If this sounds like the stuff of tabloids, luridly sensational or gimmicky, in Donoghue's talented hands, it's anything but. Told from Jack's perspective, Room turns the usual victim-survivor story on its head, transforming it into something else entirely, a meditation on the nature of reality and a testament to the ferocity of a mother's love. I think that will help give our listeners some clues as to some of the things we were kind of edging around.
I don't know if this is the right time to say it, but Emma Donoghue is a fine author and has written, this is her seventh book, and I have read most of the other ones, prize winning and all that, and I loved her books. But this, I would never have guessed it was by Emma Donoghue. Isn't that funny?
Right?
If I had picked it up without a signature, without a title, without an author, which is, interesting to do when you look at art, not to read the label right away and just to see how you react, I would never have guessed Emma Donoghue. So this is a kind of quantum leap for her imagination. Always tenacious, always correct in her research, always historically accurate. She writes historical novels, most of them, and scholarly books. Fascinating. Slammerkin,
right.
Yeah, was another prize winner,
known.
But there are many others. And right now, she tells us she's working on a book about San Francisco in the 1700s, about lowlife. Anyway, where were we, darling? I'm sorry. I ran off the script again.
Let's talk a bit about the construction of the novel.
Good idea.
It is so beautifully constructed. The plot is so compelling. There are five sections of the book. The five sections are named. They have one-name titles. The first one is called Presents, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S, that kind of like gifts. The second one is Unlying. The third is Dying. The fourth is After. And the fifth is Living. We're going to be talking about the first two, Presents and Unlying. And we're going to be talking about the last two, After and Living. The central part is where the plot turns. In the first two segments, they are living in this 11 by 11 foot room. And in the last two chapters, they are not living there anymore. And so how they got out of that room is for you readers to discover for yourself, because it's not to be given away. If anyone tries to tell you how that happens before you read the book, put your fingers in your ears and don't listen, because it's a thrilling ride through that transition from room out into what we call the real world.
Which, as our hero Jack says, is very tricksy.
Yeah, Jack is one of the most delightful protagonists I've ever met. He's totally believable as a five-year-old. Having raised children myself, I can remember almost back to when they were 5 years old. And he's very, very smart, devoted to his mom, whom he calls Ma, of course, because the first 5 years of his life have been spent in this small room with no one but his Ma. And she works constantly at making his life as good as it can possibly be within those constraints.
See? That's what every parent does, Rosemary.
Right.
Yeah,
they sing together, they count together. They do have a small television, so he watches Dora the Explorer. And he has five books, and Ma has five books. He calls her Ma throughout, so we will as well.
She has two names that other people use, he says, and we never learn them.
That's right. After they're out, he hears other people call her by the name she was, her actual name. But we don't know. And Jack continues to call her Ma. Jack is very happy in this room, 11 feet by 11 feet. Ma is not so happy, but he knows nothing else. He's never been out of this room. There are no windows. There's a skylight. And just imagine a room that's 11 feet by 11 feet. Pace it off if you want to. And think of being confined in that room for 7 years, as Ma is.
It has become almost an icon or a totem or something for people. They have built models of it. The publisher has. And Emma Donoghue herself outlined it on a home design website so that she could be tangible about it and exact. And I am amazed at how interesting that room becomes as we hear about it. Jack personifies it. Any object that has only one of them becomes not a person, because he doesn't know other people except through television, and he doesn't believe a word of television. But room is real, rug is real, and
wardrobe
very real
bed,
indeed.
Mm-hmm. Bath
and stove and refrigerator. Yes. You know, all these things become so tangible, and of course they are to all of us. As I got dressed this morning, I looked at every object with renewed affection because of rereading the novel and realizing that each of them is indeed a friend, and sometimes our best friends, the only ones present as we compose ourselves with the face, as Eliot says, to meet the faces that we meet. I should have said, Dennis Donoghue, Emma's dad, is an expert in T.S. Eliot, and there's a good deal of Eliot woven throughout as kind of homage to her papa, I'm sure, as well as to Eliot.
Amazing. And of course, I missed the Eliot completely because I don't know that much about it.
Everybody gets a different read on this, as with all good books. Yeah. it is a classic. It keeps giving, this book.
Yes.
And it is in many ways about the inside and the outside.
Yes.
And the advantages and disadvantages. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about the room.
Yeah. The objects in the room are almost characters. And Jack mentions them often, and each time they're presented in the book with a capital letter. And I think that's to remind us that they are his characters. I mean, these are the objects that he lives with. But every time you bump against one of those nouns with a capital letter, bed, bath, wardrobe, it reminded me how limited he is, and yet how he has transcended those limitations by creating for himself the characters that he needed to people his room.
I think it's the routines that the mother, that Ma, has set up.
Yes.
That are so reassuring to Jack. They're jobs for him to do. He doesn't get off. He's not spoiled in that sense at all. Mm-hmm. There are very few variations from the routine. If they're allowed, it's because it's a special occasion, his fifth birthday. Mm-hmm. He's allowed to watch more television. Mm-hmm. But he knows that if he watches too much of it, it'll rot his brain. Mm-hmm. He's very aware about germs. He's so careful because she has taught him that there are rewards to following the rules, which we often forget.
Mm-hmm.
His lack of options, which we might worry about, is actually, of course, in many ways a virtue. As those of you who have children know, too many options makes them dizzy.
Yes, which he runs into later when he's out in the real world. There's so many choices that he can scarcely cope. And I think in a way it's idyllic. One of the things that I think every child wants is to have his or her mother to himself. Here is Jack, deprived of many things, but he doesn't know he's deprived because he doesn't know they exist. And he has the total attention of his Ma for the first 5 years of his life.
Ideal in many ways, yes.
And we never doubt that he's going to be fine out in the world. His adjustments are complicated and often hilarious, but he's going to be fine. And I think that's what takes the reader through the dark part, is knowing Jack. I mean, we've been with Jack for two-fifths of this book within these constraints. We go with Jack through the exciting, thrilling part that we're not talking about today, and then we see him out in the world.
I am reassured by the structure of fairy tale.
Yes.
I know that, I mean, Emma Donoghue wrote some great feminist takeoffs on the fairy tales, by the way, which you really would be fun for other people, you know, to read once they get on the Emma Donoghue trail. But Jack, I mean, who is Jack, folks, out there? Yeah, Jack the giant killer.
Yes, and Jack and the beanstalk.
And Jack and the beanstalk.
Jack is a winner.
Jack hates green beans, you need to know. He has got a big revenge against green beans. Nursery rhymes are crucial, not only to Jack and his mom, they go through them so often, but and always with interesting results, but to Emma herself. She says that was what she nourished herself upon. And the fact that the evildoer, the captor, the tormentor, the creep in the book, is called Old Nick, should not surprise anyone. Knowing that Jack is the hero makes me think that it'll come out all right. And you see what I mean? I take comfort in the fairy tales.
Yeah. And we can also trust the author. We know from the very first sentence that we can trust the author. And she knows how to go with us through the parts that are hard to read because we're going through them with Jack.
He's an astonishing lad. I love knowing him.
Yeah. And his mother is an astonishing woman. This must get tedious for her. And she every once in a while, she's a bit sharp with him. But the atmosphere of love and affection and comfort and safety which she provides for Jack under these circumstances is what got me through that part. And it may be paradise for Jack, but it's hell for her. And I thought one of the most touching things was that she had a toothache because, of course, she hadn't been to the dentist, and she said she was made sure Jack brushed his teeth because she said that she had not been careful enough about her own teeth, and now she was suffering from it. And that was kind of like a low thunder playing in the distance for me. All the time that these days passed, I kept thinking about, oh, but Ma has a toothache, you know. And it, Jack's concern for her as well. She didn't complain, but he knew that she was suffering. And then when her tooth finally came out all by itself, he asked for it, and he kept it as a kind of a totem and a, you know, it was a magic tooth. He kept waiting for the tooth fairy to come.
Emma Donahue told us that when I got to see her, and we got to talk about that later, that...
No, let's talk about it now,
okay,
right.
Fine. That nobody in Ireland ever flossed until the year 2000. And there was lots of bad teeth there. And she said, for that part of America, I'm very grateful that they told us to. Now, this does happen in America, but if there's any criticism I have of this book, and it's not much, there are really parts of the language that don't sound all that American to me. I could almost say it's in Ireland or England or something. And Emma has lived a long time in England, 8 years in England.
You've heard Emma Donahue talk about this book.
It was at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore. I'm happy to mention them in Berkeley, a wonderful independent bookstore and a great pleasure to go to any time of the day. But when Emma Donahue was there, there were chairs everywhere. She has a huge following, and this book has a huge following in Berkeley. I was so pleased to see. And Emma Donahue was amazed and delighted to see. She was just back from China. I was delighted to hear that her book had already been translated into many languages. She said the first few months of working on the book, she read all kinds of involuntary capture, kidnapping stories with tears. Just she cried for 2 months. And she said then she got over it because she decided that there was something missing in these stories, that people dwell upon the horror, you know, as if to make their own freedom sound so good. Mm-hmm. And this will take us to the second half of the book.
Yes.
Freedom has its problems, too.
Yes.
And so many options and too much of everything. Jack knew in his room where every object was. It was very reassuring for him to know that. In the room, Jack had the feeling that Mother knew everything. Ma knew it all.
Yes, that's right.
And when she came out, again and again, he would ask her questions. God, those questions that kids ask can drive you bats anytime. And she would sometimes have to say, I don't know. And that was major for Jack to get used to the idea that his mother didn't know everything. And that's a very important part of growing up. And it happens to people who don't have such an extreme case of it as Jack did. You know, when you suddenly catch on that mom can be wrong about things. Mm-hmm. And so it is a growing up story to some extent. And that's what she intended too. Maturation, individuation, all those fancy terms. But at any rate, when I got to see Emma Donahue in person, she was proud to say that the longer the book was out, the more people began to understand that it was about, well, look at the title, Room. It's very close to womb.
That's right. Right.
And it is about that ultimate leaving of the womb and how traumatic it is, for goodness sake, and yet how full of possibility.
But Ma never forces Jack. She lets him, on these things that don't really matter, she lets him take his time and figure it out for himself. And if he doesn't want, you know, if he wants to drink the syrup out of the little cup,
made me want to drink the syrup out of the little cup. I thought, what would it taste like? Not on a pancake, I agree.
Yeah.
But if I was up against Jack, I wouldn't tell him no much either. He's a pretty determined lad.
He is. Well, we must take a break to identify ourselves to our listeners. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and my guest is J.J. Wilson, and we're talking about a book called Room by Emma Donahue, and we'll be right back.
Hush, you by, don't you cry. Go to sleep, a little baby. When you wake, you shall have all the pretty little horses, blacks and bay, dapple and gray.
coach and six little horses, blacks and bay, dapple and gray, coach and six little horses. Way down yonder in the meadow lies a poor little lamby, and the bee and the fly are picking out its eye. The poor little thing cried, "Mammy, hush you by, don't you cry. Go to sleep, a little baby. When you wake, you shall have all the pretty little horses."
This is KRCB Public Radio for Sonoma County, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by book artists Pat Nolan and Irene Nolan to talk about Pat's novel, On the Road to Las Cruces. And Barbara Quick will be here with her review of Taya Obrett's The Tiger's Wife. Now, let's return to the conversation between Rosemary Manchester and J.J. Wilson on Emma Donoghue's Room.
One of the things that struck me, you know, some things were perfectly all right and were necessary when they were in the room, and that became an issue when they were out of the room. I think about the fact that Jack was 5, and in room she was still breastfeeding him. That was the most loving and compassionate and necessary thing she could have done for that child, because he needed that nourishment. Emotionally, of course, but he needed it physically, because the food that they had, that old Nick brought them, was not particularly nutritious. And, of course, those first 5 years of childhood, she was very, very concerned. You knew she would be about his growth. And so she continued to breastfeed him. Well, now you can imagine when they come out in the real world, what's she going to do? Is she going to say, "Is Jack, no, we don't do that anymore"? Because, you know, he's so needy at this point. He's probably more needy than he was back in the room. So she continues to breastfeed him. And, of course, she gets all kinds of flack from her mother, for one thing. Her mother, what a character, who says, you're not still doing that. And people are just, they just take offense at her choice in continuing to breastfeed her 5-year-old son. And I suppose it's a reaction that any one of us would have had we not known the story, even if we did know the story, to come upon a woman nursing her child of that age. But Ma knows what Jack needs, and she continues to provide it for him. And it's fascinating to follow that part of the story when they're out in the world and in the hands of experts, because, of course, the experts are, well, for one thing, they want to study them. And another thing, they want to care for them because, of course, Jack and Ma have not been exposed to a lot of germs. And they need a lot of TLC, and they need to be protected, and most of all, they need to be kept away from the curiosity seekers, the publicity. There's a wonderful send-up of the television interview that Ma finally agrees to because they offer her a whole lot of money. And she says to Jack, "That will be your college education." And he said, "I don't want to go to college. I don't want you to do that. I don't, you know, don't do that for me, Ma." He doesn't say that in so many words. But she realizes that they will need money. And so she goes through this interview with this ditzy television reporter who constantly tries to press her into saying things. I think at one point she refers to Jack as a feral child. And Ma just loses it and says, "He's not feral. He can talk. He can add. He can read. He can write." And I think that Ma feels bad about what she couldn't do for Jack. And when, you know, she was heroic through the whole thing, and yet people are always pointing out to her out in the real world what he doesn't know or what he doesn't do.
I was sitting here remembering that in the outside world, Jack is in room number 7. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, is reassured by the numbers because that's his thing. But it isn't room. It is not that single. Mm. I think I can find a few of the quotes that say that. Ma is trying to explain to him that you can't just say no, or you can't just fend off people who are trying to be nice to you. We have our breakfast in the dining room. That's for eating just. Imagine a room just for dining. He's fascinated by all these variety of rooms. In his grandmother's house, there's even a spare room, and he can't imagine such a thing. We have our breakfast in the dining room. That's for eating just. Persons in the world like to go in different rooms for each thing. I remember manners. That's when persons are scared to make other people mad. I say, please may I have more pancakes. Now, I've never read a better description of manners than that. That's when persons are scared to make other persons mad. Think about it. That's how the tea ceremony in Japan was invented, so that you could be sure that people would be focused totally on tea and not pulling their swords out from under their skirts and starting an old feud again. So really, that's the basis for all manners. And it's a very good, sensible basis. Mm-hmm. And Jack comes to use it very nicely. Mm-hmm. He's learned to say no thanks when people are offering him these ridiculous things. Mm-hmm. And if we ever believed that we could get through life without literature, Jack will teach you. He's read those 5 books and he knows them,
that's
unlike
right.
us who have 35 books on our shelves and don't get around to reading them sometimes. And one of the quotes from Alice in Wonderland that's awfully useful here. If I or she should chance to be involved in this affair, he trusts to you to set them free exactly as we were. Imagine.
That's amazing.
Finding that in Alice in Wonderland. I've read it 100 times,
right.
But I never would have
yes.
even known. But it
right.
it takes on such meaning by the context yes. that Emma Donoghue sets up for it.
You know, one of the things that struck me is that Jack wants to go back.
Yes. Well, don't we all? Back to the womb.
Yeah, right after the escape, Jack wants to go back. And then he asks his mother several times, can't we go back? And she says, never. And it's interesting, once they're out, what different feelings they have about room. And in a way, the fact that he wants to go back is a tribute to her 5 years of devoting herself to him. But of course, she really can't see it that way, because once she's out, the thought of ever going back there is so abhorrent to her.
But for him, he finds the outside very confusing.
Yes.
And part of his trouble is knowing what's real and what isn't.
Yeah.
Now, there are marvelous things at the end. I thought I was going to mm-hmm. be so attached to the first part of the book mm-hmm. that I was not going to like it when they got out in the world. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the second part, there the issues, mm-hmm. everything that she planted in mm-hmm. the first
That's
part
right.
of the book
blooms.
Comes around again and
yes.
needs
yes.
to be rethought and reconsidered.
Right. Yes.
And I find that's true of maturation generally,
yeah.
that all that early stuff comes back to kind of grab yeah. you one way or the other. If it's not resolved, mm-hmm. you have to resolve it. And if it was resolved, you probably have to rethink it. So.
What did you think of the ending?
Now, again, I thought it was just right.
Oh, I did too. At the end of the book, Jack insists to Ma that they go back and to see room. And Ma really, really does not want to do it. But finally she consents because she sees how much it means to Jack. And maybe she has some insight into the psychology of it, you know, that letting him actually see the place and that sort of thing. But it's so hard for her to go back. And when they go back, there's a crime scene. The yellow tape is there. It's a crime scene. And he sees for the first time the house that old Nick lived in. They go through the house to get to the room in the backyard. And he thinks that the room has shrunk. And there's the mark of the around the bed where they used to do their running, and the little hole where in the floor where their feet rubbed against the floor under the table. And Jack says, I guess this really was room at one time. But not anymore, I tell Ma. What? It's not room now, he says. You don't think so? She sniffs. It used to smell even staler. The door's open now, of course. Maybe that's it. And he says, maybe it's not room, if door's open. Ma does a tiny smile. Do you? And she clears her throat. Would you like the door closed for a minute? No. Okay, she says, I need to go now. Jack says, I walk to bed wall and touch it with one finger. The cork doesn't feel like anything. And he asks, is good night in the day? And she says, huh? And he says, can we say good night when it's not night? I think that would be goodbye. And so Jack says this. He says, goodbye, wall. Then I say it to the three other walls. Then, goodbye, floor. I pat bed. Goodbye, bed. I put my head down in underbed and say, goodbye, egg snake. In wardrobe, I whisper, goodbye, wardrobe. In the dark, there's the picture of me Ma did for my birthday. I look very small. I wave over and point to it. I kiss her face where the tears are. That's how the sea tastes. I pull the picture down and zip it into my jacket. Ma's nearly at door. I go over. Lift me up. Jack, please, he says. Ma sits me on her hip. I reach up. Higher. She holds me by my ribs and lifts me. Up, up, up. I touch the start of roof, and I say, goodbye, roof. Ma puts me down thump. Goodbye, room, I wave up at skylight. Say goodbye, I tell Ma. Goodbye, room. Ma says it on mute. I look back one more time. It's like a crater, a hole, where something happened. Then we go out the door. And so that's the end of Emma Donahue's remarkable book. The name of the book is Room, and it's the story of Jack, the bravest little five-year-old I've ever met, and also the cleverest and the funniest. It's just remarkable how she's told this entire story through the words of a five-year-old. JJ, it's been such fun talking. It always is. But I love talking about books with you, and your slant is always so important because you have such a knowledge of the literature, and you catch the allusions that just go right by me. So,
Rosemary, I don't have a slant. You have a slant.
Well, perhaps we each have our own. I hope that you will feel moved to get a copy of Room and read it for yourselves. And we hope that you find it as compelling as we did.
Pat Nolan and Irene Nolan are simply put book artists. He's the longtime poet in residence of Monterio and the Russian River, and now a novelist and publisher. She is a bookseller by trade, and his daughter, and an editor and publishing partner in Newline House, the nano publisher of On the Road to Las Cruces, being a novel account of the last day in the life of a legendary Western lawman by Pat Nolan. Let's listen to the conversation the three of us had together. Pat Nolan, author and poet, many listeners know as a poet of the Russian River, a longtime resident of Monterio, whose poems have been published in everything from the Paris Review to Exquisite Corpse and everything in between. And now Pat has written and published a novel, On the Road to Las Cruces, being a novel account of the last day in the life of a legendary Western lawman. It's a Western, if you can't tell by that title, and it is told in a rather non-linear fashion that weaves the storytelling in a layered sense with a finely honed detail and articulated with some precision and clarity, I'll say. So welcome, Pat.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Suzanne.
And also in the studio is Irene Nolan, who is a partner in this publication with Newline House Publishers, a nano publishing house.
Yes, reading an article about microbreweries and the nano breweries, I thought, well, that's kind of what we are. We're a little bit smaller than a micro publisher. We're more of a nano publisher. We've just published our first book and looking at our second, but we like to think of ourselves as very small scale and focusing on that and getting our books to the people we live around, who live around us and in our community. We enjoy that moniker, nano publisher.
Pat, in the afterword of your book, you talk about this being a very long-term project of yours that maybe even had its seeds in childhood.
Well, of course, I grew up in Canada in the late 40s, early 50s, and there was no TV in those days. And so I grew up listening to radio dramas and Western radio dramas like Gunsmoke or The Lone Ranger. And I always felt a certain affinity to those kinds of fictions. And so in the process of writing this, I realized that that's what I was doing. I was touching back to those roots of, you know, my early adolescence and listening to those shows.
At the same time, it's inflected with historical fact.
It is. I did do quite a bit of research on this particular subject about this legendary Western lawman and then put it together. Then the ability to cut and paste and to move big blocks of prose around led me to put it in the structure that it's in now, which is not so much flashbacks, but definitely the opening chapter happens right at the end of this man's life. So then when you're being told the story of his life, or he's telling the story of his life, then that's in the past. And so there's a lot of talking about the past. And it's about versions of the truth. It's almost postmodern in a sense, where the truth is relative in this.
It's also a book about relationships of friendship and family. The opening scene is a wife worried about her husband.
Right, right. And she has a premonition. The slamming of a door by the wind mimics a kind of a gunshot, and she has the premonition that he's been killed. And earlier that morning, he'd gone on his way to Las Cruces to conduct some business, and he was taken in a black buggy by a man in a green bowler. And, of course, this is kind of the allegorical sense that, you know, he's been taking away to cross the River Styx, so to speak.
And the book does have what all good Westerns do possess. It has some degree of villainy and dirtiness and violence, and yet told in a very steadily paced movement, even in describing some very violent events.
Right. It's very understated in a sense. I think I purposely looked at it that way. Since it is almost a monologue on the protagonist's part, so he's just relating the facts, and he's not a man of colorful language. It's his old friend, Ash, who we meet by the time the protagonist is going down on the road to Las Cruces. It has passed away a number of years, but he's coming back into his consciousness and saying, well, if you want to tell a story, this is the way you're going to do it. And so he tries to get there, but his taciturn nature has a tendency to just keep things very factual. So there's the two types of storytelling that are going on in here. One that wants to use colorful language, and the other one that just wants to state the facts. The legendary Western lawman has no intention, or was not intending on telling these stories, but the driver of the buggy starts off by asking him very innocuous questions of, you know, what about, have you ever come across wild Indians? He's a young man, so it's, and so the legendary Western lawman is an older man, and so he starts telling the stories, and then as it develops, another story comes up, and as you're revisiting this man's life and the men that he killed, and essentially that's what it is. It is a story of violence, of his having to kill in the line of duty, and he is. You get the sense that he's a very upright and a conscientious man, but he's been put in these positions, and there's this whole thing about the regret that he has for having killed these men. And it bothers him as he's relating the story. Well, interestingly enough, or ironically, is that the man that he killed that made him a legendary Western lawman, he has no regrets about killing him. So there's this, you know, there's this kind of play, this a back and forth of his sense of duty and his sense of regret and the missteps that he made in his life. And so essentially that's the story. And of course, at the end, since the title does tell you it's the last day in his life, he has no idea, he's not sick or anything like that, and he ends up being killed.
Well, something you started talking about made me think, you said he doesn't know that this is his last day, but there are, you get the feeling that maybe he does understand a little bit. There's the foreshadowing at the beginning, the wife sort of has a premonition. And in some ways, he's almost telling like a Scheherazade tale. As the young man asks him questions, he keeps telling these stories, and then he starts remembering his friend and thinking about how can I embellish this. So a tale about storytelling, but almost at the same time, he's on that buggy and he's taken that last trip. And maybe in some way he does understand, and it's that last chance to tell that tale. And the longer you keep the tale going, you know, the longer the trip, right?
Almost forestalling the inevitable.
Well, I like your version.
Well, that is the case, isn't it, with anything you write, once you put it into a form that I can hold in my hand and I can read and we can talk about, that it suddenly takes on a different life that you can't necessarily, as the author, anticipate.
No, that's true. That's true. It becomes something totally different. And the fact that I'm also the publisher of the book, then I have another look at it as well. And so there is a conflict there. I would prefer to just write it and then let it go on its own, but to be involved in the fact of its publishing, which involves, you know, proofreading it and doing the design and all those factors of publishing.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. You wrote this novel and then entered into creating your own publishing company, and Irene Nolan, you are a partner in that, and you have a history as a bookseller in the book industry. And how did that help support the process of establishing a publishing company that now you have intentions to publish more books?
Well, just a pure love of books and reading, of course, helps. But being a bookseller, you kind of have that veil pulled away from your face, and you realize what it is that really sells books. Obviously, a book has to be well written. But there are other factors that really do go into selling a book and making a book a success. And whoever said don't judge a book by its cover obviously did not sell books, because things like a good cover and a great title can go a long way in making a book a success. So those aspects of book selling are something that I can bring to our projects, suggest things, have a feel for what looks right on the bookshelf, and maybe even an understanding of what's going to grab somebody's attention. As a very small scale publisher, we need to do anything we can to get the attention of our reader, but we don't want to maybe come across as too brash. We are a little understated in the way we approach things, and that has helped us and informed our decisions that we've made about our first project.
Pat, you've been writing for a long time. And why now? Why, with this book, have you started on this, what I consider a great new project, to move into this publishing realm?
It seemed like the time was right. And I've always been involved in self-publishing. I produced my own little handmade books. And back in the late 70s and early 80s, I had a publishing venture called Doris Green Editions, and that was all done mimeographed. So the right combination of things came together, and I thought I would put it out there and see if it was worthwhile doing. And so far, it's been a challenge, but it's also been very satisfying.
So really, you have been a publisher all along, but this is just a different sort of venture. I think some of your work is available at Quicksilver in Forestville.
That's right.
Some of Pat's really lovely. How would you describe them?
Well, limited edition handmade books with a Japanese binding, which I do all myself. And I was producing about one a year, and I've kind of stepped back from that. But it's really something I enjoy doing. I have the work that is available for publishing because I've been writing for the last 50 years. So there is an accumulation of poetry. Now we're into something, maybe the novel requires a different way of approaching that. So you need to not to have limited editions, but to have a print run that's substantial enough that you can sell it and the people will find it at bookstores and that kind of thing. Whereas the little limited editions are more like objet d'art, and not many are produced. I usually don't produce more than 50, and that would be a big press run for me. So I make them all by hand, and then I have them available at very select locations. And actually, Kaisi Horn at Quicksilver has been kind enough to carry my books, and so that's where they end up. And as I was saying, doing a novel seems to require a larger scope, that you're looking at a much wider audience than you would for poetry.
And how did it come about that you decided to work with your daughter? Or Irene, how did it come about that you decided you were going to work with your dad?
I'm trying to think of how that really came about. It may have had to do with my planning to move back to Sonoma County and knowing we would be able to work closer. But we had been discussing this for a while, hadn't we?
Right. I think, well, when we do get together, since we're both avid readers, we always talk about the books we've read. And, of course, then I'm going to talk about the books I've written, the unpublished books I've written. I figured that with Irene's expertise as a bookseller and my knowledge of book design, that we could come together and have this little family business, really. And it's just another way to engage in our love for books and our love for reading. And that ends up being the purpose behind doing New Align House, is that we want to publish books that are fun to read.
And do you have some other publications planned?
Oh, yes, we do. Quite a few. But currently, I'm working on editing a novel called The Last Resort, which is a Lee Malone adventure. And it's quite fun and pretty fast pace. We're planning that for our spring release. So 2012, spring, we should have our second project out.
I will say, Irene, welcome to the Sonoma County literary community.
Thank you.
We're so fortunate here to really be awash with writers and publishers in the county. Now, where can our listeners pick up a copy of On the Road to Las Cruces?
Currently, we have copies at select Copperfields locations and also River Reader in Guerneville and the bookstore in Sonoma.
Yeah, Reader's Books.
Now, will you be giving any readings that we might want to know about?
River Reader has been kind enough to host a book signing, and that is going to be on December 15th, which is a Thursday at 7 p.m.
Fabulous. Well, thanks so much, and I want to encourage our readers to pick up a copy of On the Road to Las Cruces, being a novel account of the last day in the life of a legendary Western lawman by Pat Nolan. Finally, Barbara Quick joins us. She is the author of Vivaldi's Virgins and The Golden Web, among others, and brings us her review of Taya Obrett's acclaimed first novel, The Tiger's Wife.
The world is always, it would seem, ready to anoint a young artist as the season's newest genius. But true genius, like true love in my opinion, can only prove itself over the course of time. Belgrade-born American novelist Taya Obrett, the youngest person ever to win the coveted Orange Prize and hailed by the literary establishment as the next new thing, certainly has a genius for detail. Her beautifully written first novel, The Tiger's Wife, is a tapestry of stories within stories set in an unnamed Balkan country which we recognize as the former Yugoslavia of Obrett's birth. The Uber story, the one that leads us to the others, is the tender remembrance of a young medical student, Natalia, for her grandfather, also a doctor, en route to an orphanage where she plans to deliver doses of vaccine across the new national border, Natalia learns that her grandfather has died. She alone was the one to whom he'd confided the secret of the cancer he knew would eventually kill him. But he's gone off from home, telling his wife and daughter that he's going to meet Natalia. It's all a seemingly benign but imponderable lie, which is the phrase that could be used to describe the other six narrative threads squiggling their way between the covers of this captivating but ultimately unsatisfying novel. Taya Obrett is more Scheherazade than Flaubert, Jane Austen, or Tolstoy. This baby-faced 26-year-old creates such enchantment with the stories and folktales layered within The Tiger's Wife that the reader, like someone curled up on the couch provided with a bottomless bowl of salty snacks, keeps going back for another handful. Only in the final stretch of the novel, when one is left with the unpopped kernels of corn and several unresolved storylines, do we realize the lack of substance in what we've just consumed as if in a trance. The novel's folktales are as lovely and evocative as they are ultimately unfathomable. there is a gripping and deliciously creepy character called the Deathless Man. But it was unclear, to this reader at least, what we are meant to make of him. And what about the tiger's wife of the title, the deaf-mute foreigner who is as blankly decorative as an illustration from a book of fairy tales? And that is to say nothing of the other four storylines that are truly evocative but fail to cohere into anything meaningful. Reading the last chapters, getting to the tiniest and most random little stories within stories in this Matryoshka doll of a novel, I felt myself grow weary. When Taya Obrett gains the wisdom and perspective that will lend meaning to her almost freakish skill, and if she can get beyond all the literary hype raining down on her, we may have one of our greatest novelists ever. Only time will tell. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Thanks for listening. This is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Tune in next month, Wednesday, December 9th at 7, when we're pleased to bring Jerry Haslam back in the studio with the book we've been waiting for, In Thought and Action, The Enigmatic Life of S.I. Hayakawa. He co-wrote the book with his wife Janice, who will join us as well.
Thank all of you for joining us.
I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
The music this evening is by Steve Clark, which you can find on his album, My Own Little World, and from the collection Cowboy Songs of the Old West, collected and sung by Alan Lomax and Ed McCurdy. A Novel Idea is produced by Suzanne Lang for KRCB. Listen to the podcast at www.krcb.org.